When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
This is The Crossover, an NBA show hosted by Sports Illustrated's Chris Mannix and Howard Beck.
It's a whole new level for you and me, Chris, this relationship.
Like and subscribe for the best weekly NBA content these two are capable of.
What does that mean?
Could be the best duo ever.
I don't see how you can beat that.
Here they are, Chris Mannix and Howard Beck.
All right, Crossover NBA podcast, Chris Mannix and Howard Beck. And Howard, we begin this pod with some tough news for the Celtics. The breaking news on Monday, Rob Williams has a torn meniscus in his left knee. Rob, of course, the anchor of the Celtics defense, a strong candidate for the one of the two slots, center slots, in the all-defensive team, certainly in the mix this year for defensive player of the year. The Celtics have the number one defense in the NBA by a mile, and now they will be without their starting center for the foreseeable future. Now, there was no timetable given on this injury to Rob Williams. Should point that out from the start. And look, there have been players that have had somewhat quick recoveries from meniscus tear. In context, this is not the this is the better ligament to tear. You know, in this case, like, you don't want to tear the ACL, that's for sure. If you have some kind of partial tear of the meniscus, you can bounce back from that one in a matter of weeks. So I think that's probably best case scenario for Boston. Worst case, he misses the playoffs, and I don't know the Celtics can survive without Rob Williams in the middle in the playoffs. So give me a reaction to the news about Rob Williams and his knee injury.
Yeah, I mean, brutal. I was just thinking about this, Chris. Like, a couple weeks ago, we were talking about, hey, we should really all be discussing the Miami Heat as legit threat to win the East. And of course, the Heat have fallen off a cliff. We'll talk about them later. Last week, we were talking about, are the Celtics the favorites now to win the East? Because they were just absolutely crushing everybody, not just recently, but really for the last couple of months. And just when we get used to the idea that, you know what, maybe Boston's the best team in the East, now they're potentially losing Rob Williams, and we don't know for how long and how serious this is. I will say, and let me put my I'm not actually a doctor hat on, but I've torn my meniscus before hat. If people remember, Dwayne Wade in college tore his meniscus. And you can have a partial tear. You can have a bigger tear. Like, it's part of it's where it is. Part of it is how much of a tear. And then part of it is how you treat it. So the way I recall this is that with certain meniscus tears, if you want surgery to repair it, you're better off long term. But in the short term, it's a longer recovery. And Dwayne Wade went the opposite direction in college. He got they snipped the loose piece. And so he got back quicker, but he had arthritis problems later. And so there's that part of it. But we don't know the extent of Rob Williams' injury yet, right? So we don't know if surgery or not. We don't know rehab or not. We don't know what strategy they're taking or how severe it is. So we'll probably know more by the next time you and I are on this pod in a week.
Yeah. I'd say this about the Wade stuff. I recall Wade talking about that later in his career and saying he wished he didn't do it. Saying you wish he had it repaired and not have that piece removed, because to your point, it did cause him problems with the knee later in his career. Rob Williams is just entering the prime years of his career. As much as you want to win now, it's probably not advisable to do something that might impact you in the long term. Look, we've got a couple of weeks to go in the regular season. You know, Daniel Tice, who will most likely fill in for Rob Williams. Al Horford, I'm sure, will play a lot of center. Grant Williams will get opportunities, more opportunities, I think, as a power forward. They can get by this regular season and maybe even finish as the top seed in the Eastern Conference. But Rob's shot blocking, his presence, his ability to switch onto everyone, including ones. Like, that's, I've talked about this a few times before. I know I've written it. Like, the key to the Celtics defense is that their point guard can defend centers if necessary, and their center can defend point guards. Like, that is, I don't want to call it unique, but it's certainly rare amongst NBA teams historically. And without Rob Williams, I don't know how they're going to maintain the level of defensive intensity and defensive acumen that they've had before. I mean, it's not, look, losing Tatum would be unrecoverable. Losing Jaylen Brown would probably be unrecoverable. But losing Rob Williams, that's a body blow, man. Like, the Celtics, in the span of like 24 hours, after watching the Celtics just clobber Minnesota on Sunday, just battered them. And Minnesota had been out there clobbering everybody else. Like, they had been playing well over the last few weeks. Watching the Celtics just whoop them in that second quarter and put the game away with a 23-point halftime lead. I mean, you kind of went at me, like, when I, you know, was tweeting about this. You told me to kind of slow my roll.
You're your thesaurus.
Yeah, you told me to kind of slow my roll there, Mr. Hater. But, like, the Celtics have been, like, the last couple of weeks, like, they've played top-tier teams, yeah, and they've been obliterating them. Since that loss to Dallas, the Celtics went 6-0 and were beating teams by an average, I think, of 16 points per game. Like, these games weren't close. So they went from a team that looked like the front runner to come out of the East in the playoffs to now, I don't know what they are. They still have Tatum and Brown. Their offense is still going to be really good, but, you know, Rob's absence is glaring.
I think on Twitter you had gone from they're obliterating everybody to bludgeoning everybody.
Bludgeoning.
I think my concern, aside from just the like gory violence that bludgeoning implied, was that you might run out of strong enough verbs to describe what the Celtics were doing before we even got to the playoffs. But justifiable. I'm not. Listen, you were justified in your choice of ever stronger verbs because that's what they were doing. When you've got a guy like Rob Williams, it makes it empowers everybody else on your defense, right? Like, if you're Jaylen Brown, who's a great defender anyway, and so is Marcus Smart, or if you're Jason Tatum, if you're any of these guys, when you know you've got a guy behind you who can obliterate your mistakes, erase your mistakes, wipe out attempts at the hoop, change shots, it enables you to be that much more aggressive on the perimeter. And so those guys are still good to great defenders on their own. But when you lose the safety net behind you, it's going to have an impact. But hey, listen, you know, credit to Brad Stevens now for the deals he made at the deadline, because in getting Derek White, you know, another stout perimeter defender, in getting Tice, who, while not a Rob Williams, at least is an upgrade from what they had with Ennis Freedom, for sure, defensively. Like, they're in better position to weather this now than they would have been. But if, let's just be clear here, if Rob Williams doesn't come back in time for the postseason or is not around for the important parts of the postseason, I think this takes the Celtics from potential finals contender to, you know, dropping them back a notch or two, especially when the East is as strong as it is right now, you know, with the Bucks, with presumably the Heat, if they can pull it back together, with the Sixers. There's not a lot of room for error here.
I would even call them a championship contender. Like, I know everybody's kind of looking at Phoenix right now as being the team to beat, but a Celtics team with a point guard that can defend Chris Paul in Smart, a two guard in Jaylen Brown who can defend Devin Booker, the kind of size up front that could give the Suns problems, like, they're on that level. They were on that level before this injury. Hopefully Rob Williams, for the Celtics' sake, can get back in time for a playoff push. You mentioned the Heat, so let's turn to them for a minute. Howard, we discussed the Heat last week and potential warning signs there. And I got to tell you, like, in the aftermath of that, I heard from a lot of people, whether it's on social media or direct messages from people I know, you know, now you're talking about the Heat. The first time you talk about the Heat and it's, you're criticizing them. You're saying they're not the real deal, that they're not on the same level as Milwaukee or Philadelphia. And all we were really talking about that time was, yeah, look, they don't have a superstar down there. And when you go into the playoffs, teams with the best player often win series. And against a lot of teams in that mix at the top of the conference, you know, Jimmy Butler would not be the best player in those matchups. Also, Tyler Hero was starting to get gashed and did in a recent game against Philadelphia. Since then, Things have gotten worse down in Miami. They've gotten measurably worse, kind of bottoming out in the middle of a game last week against Golden State where Jimmy Butler tried to fight Eric Spoelstra. Eric Spoelstra tried to fight Jimmy Butler. Udonis Haslem tried to fight Jimmy Butler. That was one of the wildest scenes I've ever seen on an NBA sideline with so many layers to it. I mean, you had Butler appearing to challenge Spoelstra to a fight if you watch the video from that one camera angle. You had Haslem going off protecting his coach like he's a bodyguard. Then you have Spoelstra, who is not known for, you know, these types of outbursts on the sideline, going after Butler, picking up a clipboard from somewhere, and then throwing it in Butler's direction. I mean, what was your takeaway from that, and how bad are things right now for the Heat?
Listen, you know how this goes, right? In the immediate aftermath, it's no big deal. Guys get on each other's nerves. You spend a lot of time together, yada, 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 all that stuff. And then there's also the, this could galvanize us, all the usual happy talk. And I'm willing to, like, give a little bit of room for all that in the sense that, yes, sometimes guys get on each other's nerves, and a lot of these blow-ups happen when there are no cameras on and they're not during games. It's during practices. We don't see it. We have no idea. And it happens to teams that go on to win championships. Okay, fine. But when you've lost four in a row, as they have at the time of this recording, and as badly as they have, as gruesomely as they have, and it's in the wake of that blow-up between players and coach and everything, it is absolutely fair, absolutely justified, and it would be foolish not for us all to look at it and think, you know what? Something's wrong. Something's wrong. Like, these things are not coincidental. Every bone in my body, every bit of my 25 years of experience covering this league tells me that the Heat have deeper issues. Now, doesn't mean they can't overcome them. Doesn't mean that they can't pull themselves back together. But chemistry can be a fragile thing. And to the point of our discussion last week, Chris, which we were accurate in and which you just restated, the Heat have less margin for error because they don't have a Giannis or a Kevin Durant or a Joel Embiid. Jimmy Butler's really, really good. I love Jimmy Butler. I'd want him on my team as long as he's not trying to kill my coach. Kyle Lowry's great. Bam Adebayo's great. None of these guys are at the level of a Giannis or a KD or an Embiid or a LeBron or a Steph Curry. And they need everything to go right. They need their offense to be in perfect sync to generate shots for everybody. They need to be on a string defensively, although they've got a bunch of really good individual defenders. And they've got the shooting, they've got the playmaking, like they've got the requisite stuff to win a title. But for them, there's no margin for error because they don't have that one guy who's an MVP caliber player who can manufacture a shot, a play, an opportunity out of thin air. So when things start to fray like this with their chemistry, I think it's an even bigger concern because their chemistry matters more.
Yeah, I'm not buying the, you know, we are worse like this, worse than this in practice stuff, or no big deal. Like, it's a big deal. Let me start with Spoelstra, because that was top of mind there, because I'd never seen him go off like that. He is the picture of control on the sideline. And this has been mentioned before, but you go back to when Ray Allen made the shot in the finals years ago, the camera cut to Eric Spoelstra on the sideline, and he didn't move. He didn't blink. He didn't celebrate, leap in the air, nothing. He was a picture of calm. You go back even further, when LeBron shoulder bumped him in that moment, when they were under 500 or right around 500, Spoelstra didn't overreact to that either at any point, whether it was during the game or after the game. How he reacted here was something. That was a story. I don't know what pushed him to that point. You know, Jimmy Butler has a history of rubbing organizations the wrong way. Like, he was out of Minnesota in part because he couldn't get along with the players on that roster. He bailed on Philadelphia in part because he had issues with some of the players on that team, specifically Ben Simmons. Might have been right about that. But, you know, Butler is not, this is a pattern now with Jimmy Butler. Now, he's a great competitor, a great player, and they may be able to brush this aside, but we can't act like they're going to. Like, not only did they have that incident, but they've been losing. They've been losing a lot in the last couple of weeks. You know, you hear Kyle Lowry, who has been one of the daily voices of this team continue to publicly voice concern about where they are right now. And I don't think you can just dismiss that and say, look, they've been the number one team for weeks now in the Eastern Conference. They've got great depth. Outside of Tyler Hero, they're really good defensive players. You know, a lot of guys have been deep in the playoffs. That's all great. I get it. But, you know, there's clearly some issues internally within that team. And I don't think it's as simple as, you know, it's a tough stretch and we're really competitive and we're, you know, we're really united. It's going to bring us all together. I just don't buy that. I think there's a fissure there. I think there's a crack there within that team that makes me legitimately concerned about how far they can go in the playoffs.
Yeah, I mean, I agree. I don't think this means that, I don't think we should say it's irreparable. I don't think we should say that these are fissures that can't be filled, patched up before the playoffs. They could pull it right back together and they might be fine. But it's a massive warning sign. Yeah, it's a big flashing red light that says something is awry. And if they can't pull it back together, then whatever that is, it could sink them before this thing even really gets going. You know, all that said, I give the benefit of the doubt to this. Like, they've been this good this long this season. I think they're still a legit contender in the East until further notice. Maybe this slide of the last week ends whatever their next game is. Maybe they turn it right around. It's possible. That's also possible. But their margin for error is smaller than the other contenders in the East. And, you know, the East is better than it used to be. So even a team at the bottom of the playoff bracket could be a threat if you're not at your best. You know, we'll talk about the Nets later. And I don't believe the Nets are a true threat in the East. But could they knock out a Heat team that's coming apart at the seams? If that's the case, yeah.
Yeah, they've lost four games in a row going into Monday night's game against Sacramento. The two wins before that were against bottom feeders Detroit and Oklahoma City. Lost to Minnesota before that. So they're also entering a tough stretch. They play Boston on Wednesday, Chicago on Saturday, then at Toronto on Sunday. That's a three-game stretch. And Charlotte's right after that, Atlanta. So they don't have any gimmies, really, the rest of the season.
So we'll know soon. Yeah, we'll know soon.
Yeah, and you look at the top of the Eastern Conference standings, I mean, you got four teams basically separated by like half a game right now. So this is a Heat team that while they've been in first place for a little while, they could easily slip into that four spot before the end of the season. So, I mean, to kind of boil it all down about the chief concerns here, my chief concern is that this blow-up on the sideline was something substantive, that it whatever happened in that huddle was the straw that broke the camel's back. And that led to a bad loss at home against New York, a blowout loss at home against Brooklyn. Like, there have just been some bad losses since then. I'm also, from a basketball standpoint, I'm legitimately concerned about the targeting of Tyler Hero. Like, this team needs Tyler Hero's offense, but they got to figure out how to keep him on the floor defensively. He's surrounded by really good defensive players. Pretty much the four guys they put around Tyler Hero are going to be excellent defensively, but he's become a target, and it's a copycat league. So you're going to see, you know, in these coming games and in the playoffs, when Hero's on the floor, teams going to try to find a way to isolate him and attack him. I'm very interested to see how Eric Spoelstra, one of the best coaches in the NBA, how he deals with that.
Yeah, absolutely. And just look at the standings real quick, as you point out how tightly packed it is. If they were to slip to fourth, you're now talking about a possible first-round matchup against the Bulls, who are currently fifth, or if Toronto leapfrogs them, a first-round matchup against Toronto would not be easy either. You know, you're looking at, you know, and it doesn't take much to slip. I mean, we're talking about a half game separating them from fourth place. Being in that 4-5 slot is setting them up for potential failure in the first round.
All right, let's talk about Brooklyn, a team you wrote about this week. You're very, very angry, Howard, at Kyrie Irving, aren't you? You're just, you're taking issue.
Not angry. Just someone needs to point out the truth, lest it get clouded.
All right. So then let you take this part here, because the Nets have lost two of the last three. Kyrie's first home game of the season was not good. They lost to Charlotte and Irving played poorly. You know, where do you see the Nets right now? How do you see them amongst the contenders in the conference?
I don't. And that's the thing. Well, I mean, listen, In the abstract, if you just said, hey, here's a bunch of teams and here's their two best players, and you said one of them's got KD and Kyrie, I would say, well, if Kyrie Irving is actually available for most of the season, which he frequently is not, not just this season, KD and Kyrie as a 1-2 punch is electrifying. And we've seen that this season, right? And we've seen each of these guys just have monster games on their own and in tandem. So it's not to downplay the potency of the Nets with Kevin Durant and Kyrie Irving. It's not to downplay Kevin Durant, period. That guy still, any given night in the NBA, you could say is the best basketball player on earth. Kevin Durant wins games by himself sometimes, and has been forced to, by the way, win games by himself far too often this season. But I look at volatility a lot, right? Like you know me, we've been doing this pod for a while. I talk about like the volatility index, right? Fake thing that I just made up in my own head. Maybe one day I'll actually create it on paper. But the volatility, if you look at all the teams that we would consider contenders because of their talent, and then you consider all the caveats you would put there, the volatility, the Nets have more volatility than anyone and have all season, right? All right, Kyrie Irving can finally play home games. Okay, great. Hallelujah. He can play home games. So he can now play the remaining seven games, as we speak, on their schedule. That'll give them a nice run before the playoffs of Kevin Durant and Kyrie Irving together, home and road, for the first time all season. But Andre Drummond is a starting center for this team. He's been around for all of, you know, a month and a half. Seth Curry came in the same trade with Drummond, the Ben Simmons Harden swap. Those guys are still kind of new to this team. They have been, and Seth Curry's been in and out because of injury. They have been dealing with a Nets team that up until now has been this two different versions of the Nets. There's the home version with no Kyrie, the road version with Kyrie. They're still waiting on Ben Simmons. Ben Simmons might get healthy before the end of the season, in which case now you're plugging in a really important player who has never played a minute or even practiced a minute with this team. And you're going to plug him in just before the playoffs or possibly once the playoffs start, whenever his back is finally ready. That's a lot of variables, Chris.
Can I ask you about that? How does Ben Simmons have a back injury? Like, how are we here? Ben Simmons hasn't played all season long, and now he's got a back injury. Like, how did we get to this point? Like, well, does that not seem odd to you that we're sitting here, what's it, over a month after the trade?
Yeah.
And we're sitting here and Ben Simmons still hasn't played because of a back injury?
Listen.
Like, does that pass the smell test for you? Like, I don't get it.
This has been weird from the start, right?
What has he been doing? I mean, he hasn't been at the Sixers facility all that much. By all accounts, he's played like pickup games here or there, and he's got a back injury so debilitating that he can't play?
I think it was 2 years ago heading into the playoffs where he missed the last 7-8 games of the Sixers season or something because of a back injury.
I get it. I get it, Howard, but like, so he hasn't played since May.
I don't know.
What,
I know.
What are we doing
here? All right, so just saying. All right, backdrop. There's a history here. Secondly, if we go back to the fall, when we had this moving target of why Ben Simmons was not reporting or didn't want to practice, didn't want to play, didn't want to be a Sixer, whatever, the trade demand had not been fulfilled. So initially it's, well, didn't get traded and he's sour about not being traded yet. Then it was them alluding to possible mental health concerns or he's not mentally ready or whatever that phraseology that they chose at the time was. Then they did flag at one point also a back concern, even then. This was before Doc Rivers, I think, kicked him out, and they just said, you know, go away and we'll figure this out later. Well, you know, we'll resolve this with the trade eventually. So the back thing has been looming in the background, but you're right, Chris. Something about this is off. To go all those months, because think of it this way. If Ben Simmons' primary reason for not practicing or playing with the Sixers was the back, he would have just said that. Nobody is going to voluntarily say, I'm not mentally ready because of all of the other things that that invites, all the backlash and scrutiny and potential mockery and a lot of other ugly things that that invites. You don't go there if you can just lean on the fact that you are physically injured. That's always going to be your first line of defense for why I'm not showing up and not playing. And if that had been the case, we would have been hearing about it the whole time. So the way this unfolds, I mean, I don't think the Nets are inventing the epidural that he got or inventing the L6 disc or whatever that's causing him problems now. I do think that this means that somewhere along the way, this was a lower concern or a lesser concern because he probably hadn't been going that hard physically. Then he gets to the Nets, and now he's starting to try to ramp up for them, and boom, something gets flared up.
Well, there's the thing.
That's the way I read it.
There's the thing, Howard. If this happened after he got to Brooklyn, maybe because he tried to ramp up too fast or bad luck, then what are you going to do? All right, I understand that. But if there was something that was bothering him over the course of the last few months, like, why wasn't he in every day getting treatment? Like, if nothing else, you have access to a world-class facility. Like, I know you don't want to go in there when your teammates are there because you didn't want to be around them, but, like, you have access to the best training staff and medical treatments in the world. And
yeah.
I guess that's my biggest question. Like, if it's bad luck, it's bad luck. You go do things too fast, sometimes that happens. But this guy hasn't played since May. I just have a hard time believing that, you know, he couldn't have dealt with this before. I don't understand it. I really don't.
Yeah. I don't know. I don't know. We don't have, you know, enough information on this one. But yes, it is a strange situation.
They need Ben Simmons. Like, their defense is not good without Ben Simmons.
No.
Like, they need...
Right, so... Yeah. So, they need Ben Simmons, as you say. Their defense is not good, as you say. And on top of that all, like, as I've been saying, this whole season has been incredibly choppy. And I just think that that is too many things to deal with. I've said this before, and I think I said it with regard to the Nets last season. If we're going to talk about how important chemistry is, and continuity, and cohesion, and all this stuff, then we can't just pretend it doesn't matter when we go, oh, but they got KD and Kyrie, everything will be fine. No, it's not that simple. And you know, look, I'm not putting much stock in what happened with Kyrie last night, although I did joke as he was, you know, going, you know, 2 for 12 or whatever in the first half. Like, is this home court rust? Is he just not used to playing at home anymore? But no, they got in at like 3 or 4 in the morning after a flight back from Miami. And was it Miami? Where were they the night before? They got home really late. They're on a back-to-back. Everybody was kind of gassed, whatever. I'm not putting too much stock in that. But the idea that the Nets are going to go, they're going to start in the play-in. If they're eighth and Toronto slips to seventh again, they're going to have to go to Toronto with no Kyrie because Toronto, you know, Canada is still not allowing anybody unvaccinated across its borders. So there's still that possibility. But let's say they avoid Toronto. They have to win a play-in. They may have to play 2 play-in games. We'll see. As of right now, they're 9th by tiebreaker, so they'd have to win 2 play-in games just to become the 8th seed. Then, as the 8th seed, they're getting maybe Boston, maybe Milwaukee, maybe still Miami, maybe Philly. And now you're going to try to win a best-of-7 with no home court advantage. If they get out of the first round, they upset the 1 seed, the second round of the conference finals might still both feature 50-win teams because there are that many 50-win teams or on pace for 50 in the top part of the bracket, and they're coming from the bottom part. You're going to have to win 3 series against 50-win teams with no home court advantage and possibly while plugging in a maybe-healed Ben Simmons somewhere along the way. Like, it's too much, Chris. No, they're not a contender to win the East this year.
Yeah, one of the reasons I was optimistic about the Nets coming into this season because they went into the playoffs last year and their defense was significantly improved. It struggled in the first part of last season, but was a lot better in the playoffs. Not elite, but like top middle of the pack, top half of the league type of defense. This year, it hasn't been. They're bottom third in the NBA right now in defensive efficiency, and they've been getting gashed by some teams. So that's a problem. And so as good as Irving and Durant are, without Ben Simmons having to run through the gauntlet, I'm not going to say it's impossible because Kevin Durant does some amazing things and Kyrie's still capable of being Kyrie, you know, a finals MVP type of player. But I think it's going to be a big-time uphill climb for them to get there. All right, I want to ask you about this raging debate about All-NBA. Right now, you can only vote for one center on the All-NBA ballot, which has caused a stir because in all likelihood, the top 2 players on the MVP ballot are going to be centers, Joel Embiid and Nikola Jokic. Giannis, of course, can find his way in there. Luka Doncic, some others, but whatever. Those 2 guys are presumably the front runners for the award. The NBA, as I said, can only vote for one center. And you've had some people, Drew Hanlon, the trainer for Joel Embiid, he's weighed in on this. upset that there's been a fervor to get Nikola Jokic on that first team. What's your reaction to all that's gone on involving the All-NBA, and is there a solution that the NBA can find for all this?
Yeah, so the debate, Chris, is essentially identical to what it was a year ago. So a year ago, Embiid and Jokic were also considered the two front runners for MVP. So you had to choose between them to and who's to put at the top of the MVP ballot, but also because All-NBA is still structured as two guards, two forwards, and a center, there was the choice of Jokic versus Embiid there. Oh, but the NBA last year, in creating its ballot, which is electronic for all of us who are voters, made Embiid and Jokic both forward eligible. And they have done that again this season. So the real debate right now that's going on, and it's kind of a weird one, is do we classify one of these guys as forward so as not to have the awkward optics of them being 1-2 for MVP, but one of them falling to second team All-NBA?
Is it possible, Howard, just to clarify this, because I think people are interested in this. Like, if you vote for Embiid, if you would kind of need a consensus amongst the voters, right? Like, we're going to classify Jokic as a center and Embiid as a power forward, or vice versa. Like, otherwise, like, is it possible both these guys could slip off the first team ballot because they might split votes at power forward and center?
No. The way this works is the NBA will give the guy the credit at whichever position he got the most votes at. So, a couple things here. One, there are 100 voters. Contrary to bizarre conspiracy theories that sometimes float around out there, there is no way for 100 people to coordinate with each other. It doesn't happen. Just put that aside. Even if we...
Unless you are answering Tim Bontemps' straw poll.
I did answer his straw poll. I already want to change my ballot. So...
I have text messages with Tim where, like, he'll send me, like, these texts, be like, can you send me your top five? And I go, no. Like, a day later, can you send me your top five? No. Like, basically, I want to make sure every time I'm the last person to submit a ballot.
I only do that with the official ballot, and Mark Broussard at the NBA has to wait for mine at midnight every year.
Yeah, me too.
So, I mean, listen, we will have some, I guess, pseudo-clarity when Bontemps' poll comes out again on ESPN.com in the next day or so. So that'll give us a little bit of a clue. But I think, one, Giannis is very firmly in the mix for the number one slot also. At least he is for me. And I think I'm probably not alone in that. So, one, I think there will be a split of the number one slot on the ballot between at least three players, Giannis, Jokic, and Embiid. The idea, let's tackle this idea about whether Embiid and Jokic can both be first team, because that's what this is really coming down to. This actually bothers me. This one irritates me. And a lot of smart people I know have said, you know what? It's fine. Put them both first team. And the rationale for doing it is this. Not only are they 1-2 for MVP in a lot of people's minds, but they both play like power forwards, right? Like, they don't really play at traditional centers. And actually, Jokic plays more like a guard. And aren't we in a positionless era? Yes, kind of, but Steph Curry is only eligible at guard. Ja Morant is only eligible at guard. We got a bunch of great guards. In fact, for years, we had Curry and Harden and Westbrook and Chris Paul and Dame Lillard and Clay and Kyrie, like all worthy first team guards in a given year. Guess what? You make hard choices. That's what this whole exercise is about. Sometimes you make the hard choice. Credit to my buddy Mark Stein, who already wrote this in his column on Substack, but I'm going to steal it now. Bill Russell, the great Bill Russell, the greatest champion in the history of this game. You know how many first teams he made in his career, Chris? Three.
Well, he played with, would Wilt get all of them?
Right. So Bill Russell had he made second team eight times, first team only three times, and he's Bill freaking Russell. Finished behind Bob Pettit once, finished behind Wilt the other seven times. This happens. It's always happened. We have a league where even today, everybody turns in a lineup card that has two guards, two forwards, and a center. Is it a little more fluid than it's ever been? Yes. Can we still kind of identify who plays what based on size and their duties on the court? Yeah. Why is there only one center on the first team? Because there's 30 starting centers, but there's 60 starting forwards and 60 starting guards. It's proportional. This is basic. Great players who are worthy of the first team have always finished second. Like, there's always been some guys who you said, man, I can't believe I can't fit them all in the first team, but I got to make the tough choice. Whether that's Bill Russell and Wilt, or in this case, Embiid and Jokic. That we are fudging the rules, that the NBA is doing this, frankly, because they create the ballot. We don't. The NBA is fudging the rules to make Jokic and Embiid both eligible. This is like participation trophy type stuff, folks. This is like saying, oh, we don't want to hurt anybody's feelings. No, tough shit. Sometimes somebody has to be second team. It's okay. We'll all live. They will live. I frankly think that some of their fans and some of their supporters and their advocates, like Drew Hanlon for Embiid, are more worried about it than they are and are going to some rather extreme positions. And I just want to make this quick correction because I was going to respond on Twitter and I decided I don't like getting these public things.
No, you respond here because you make no money off Twitter. Respond here on the podcast. That's why you respond on your platform.
So Drew Hanlon's tweet on March 20th, I don't know Drew at all.
I know Drew. Sure I've been talking to Drew for a story for the last few days. I like Drew.
All right, listen. Drew, I'm sorry, you're wrong. His tweet is this. If you don't think some media members have an agenda, think about this. When Joel was MVP runner-up last year, they had no problem putting him on second team. Now that Jokic will probably finish as MVP runner-up, they want to change the voting process so he's on first team. No, wrong on every count. The NBA creates the rules, the media doesn't. The NBA created the rules actually starting 2 years ago to allow Jokic and Embiid both to be classified as forward or center. The NBA sets the structure. The media only fills out the ballots. So the media doesn't have an agenda and the media can't control this. The process is controlled by the NBA. We simply vote. By the way, the reason that your client, Joel Embiid, finished second last year is because he missed 30% of the season. That's why he finished behind Jokic for MVP. That's why he then finished behind him on the All-NBA voting as well. There's no conspiracy. There's no agenda. This is just basic stats and basic assessment of a season. Joel Embiid missed a third of the season, and it hurt him. That's unfortunate. Play the full season, as he pretty much is. I mean, he's a lot closer this season anyway.
He's going to have career highs in games played when it's all said and done.
And by the way, the media loves Joel Embiid. Like, what possible agenda is there to try to, deny him some honor? Like, give me a break. So that bugged me because you're impugning the reputations and credibility of the entire voting panel and unfairly and inaccurately, basically. Because, like I say, we don't control the process. The NBA sets the process, and the process is identical this year with both those guys eligible at both forward and center as it was last season. So, by the way, one last thing on this. I think the problem we're having with this discussion, Chris, we collectively, right? Media, fans, everybody talks about the NBA, is that people say, well, the All-NBA is the top 15 players. You know what? It's not. It's not. You know how I know? Because you don't have to go that far back that far to find DeAndre Jordan as a third team All-NBA center a couple times, and Andre Drummond as an All-NBA third team center, and Al Jefferson as an All-NBA third team center. Do you think DeAndre Jordan, Andre Drummond, or Al Jefferson were one of the top 15 players in the NBA? No, they were simply that season the third best center. Now, if you say, well, okay, that proves that the ballots are flawed, fine. If you want to go completely positionless, eliminate it entirely, then we can actually identify the top 15, top five, next five, next five, irrespective of position. The top five might be all guards, by the way, or maybe it'll be all forwards 1 year. Maybe it'll be all centers 1 year. That will be the new reality if you eliminate positions. But the NBA hasn't actually eliminated positions. They've only fudged it for Jokic and Embiid and a few others who have multi-position eligibility. But we need to not talk about All-NBA as top 15 when it's really the top six guards, the top six forwards, and the top three centers. That's the reality of the ballot. Okay, rant over.
Let's also not forget the dirty little underbelly of All-NBA and where guys land is that guys get paid off it. Their contracts, they make All-NBA X team, Y team, they get paid off it.
I don't think it's first, second, or third team. I think it's just getting All-NBA.
Right,
period.
I'm more saying like just, you know, yeah, making those teams in general, like that's
right. But I want to make that clear, Chris, lest fans think that we are affecting them even by which team we're placing them on. No, it's either you make All-NBA or you don't. Right. That's the trigger.
Let me just put a button on this with this thought. Like, is the middle ground doing what the NBA did for All-Star? I mean, they made the front court positionless. They said pick three guys in the front court. Yeah. Is that not the easiest way to kind of fix all this?
Yeah, I mean, look, they could go two guards and three front court for All-NBA just as they did for All-Star, which, hey, for consistency's sake, I don't know why they don't anyway.
That's what I'm saying. Like, but Howard, this is like why it seems like it would work. It's painfully obvious. Like, first team All-NBA should be Jokic, Embiid, and Giannis to me. Like, those are the three best front court players, I think. I preferred if they went just with front court. I mean, because I've now become conditioned over recent years of not thinking about centers for All-Star as I vote for that. I figure, like, you do it in midseason, why not do it at the end of the season? That, to me, makes the most sense.
Yeah, it does. I also think there's just this aesthetic part of it, or the way we understand the game, which is when you're talking about the All-NBA first team, and when we do think of it in terms of guards, two guards, two forwards, two center, that, you know, the traditional alignment, you're probably never building a team with Jokic and Embiid, right? Like, could they play together? Sure. Are you building it that way intentionally? No. No one's doing
that. Hey, Cleveland Cavaliers, baby. Jared Allen, Evan Mobley. They're building twin towers out there, and they're damn successful.
Yep, but Evan Mobley is not a traditional five in any way.
He's like 7 feet tall, though. Like, he's still a big guy.
Yeah, but so is Kevin Durant, and so is Kevin Garnett, and so is Giannis. But, like, it's, you know, it's skill set, it's fluidity, it's the athleticism on the perimeter, it's all that stuff, right? So I think, you know, listen, this is by eye of the beholder stuff. If you still feel like, you know what, the NBA for tradition's sake and consistency's sake, so we can still compare the All-NBA of 2022 to the All-NBA of 1972, and you want two guards, two forwards, two center, fine. If you say, no, we're in a positionless era and you want it completely positionless, fine. If you want to go two guards and three front court to make it consistent with All-Star, fine. I think all of these are totally defensible. I don't care which the NBA picks. I just want people to be consistent in the way that they're assessing this and critiquing it, and understand that the NBA has set the rules of engagement on this. They create the ballot. They decide who's eligible where. The media, we just vote. And I don't like being put in a position where you're telling me Embiid and Jokic can be put in at forward when I know they're not forwards. Neither of them is starting any games at forward for their respective teams. Do not tell me they're forwards and then expect that, then put this burden on us to decide whether we should fudge reality. And by doing it, by the way, there's a ripple effect. If you put two centers on the first team, you're robbing a forward spot. Now you're bumping somebody else. So the debate isn't so much Jokic versus Embiid. It's also the guy that you might not pick, or it's, if you pick both, it's those guys versus Jason Tatum or Kevin Durant or somebody else that you're now bumping to second team because you've taken away one of the forward spots. So, like, what are we trying to do here? If you're trying to save face or save somebody's feelings or whatever it is, somebody's eventually affected because there's still only 15 slots and there's always a ripple effect. It's just a weird thing. Also, and we've just shown it again here, we're all expending a tremendous amount of energy on something that's really, like, it never seemed this important in a pre-social media era. Somewhere along the way between social media and, like, a lot more lobbying than, like, you know, whether it's Drew Hanlon or whether it's Daryl Morey, whether it's whoever lobbying for their guys, it starts to get a little over the top and it turns into this, you know, other warped discussion.
Hey, Stan Van Gundy did it the other night. I was watching the Nuggets game that was on TNT, and Stan Van Gundy, who I love, Stan says something to the extent of, if voters are doing their job right, they need to make Jokic a two-time MVP. I'm like, okay, all right. Like,
the absolutism kills me.
Is Stan going to say that? Stan, are you going to say that when you call the next Sixers game and Embiid goes for like 40 and 13? There is no absolute here. It's a very, very tough vote with three very qualified guys.
And by the way, Chris, you and I know this. There are years where it feels obvious, right? Like, I thought Jokic was the clear guy last year. I thought Giannis's first year for sure. I thought the two-time Steph won it. Like, there are a lot of years where it is clear. I think this one is incredibly tough.
Yeah.
And the way Tatum has played the last couple of months, I think you have to consider. People are saying, you know, well, how can you not consider Devin Booker? Like, we could do this on and on.
How about Tatum? I'll tell you a quick story on Tatum before we finish this part of the conversation. Tatum is like, I think he's going to land in the top five. You know, I think those last two slots, whether it's Luka, Devin Booker, Tatum, I think Tatum's going to get
John
one of those
Morant.
Last. John Morant just missed a lot of games, though, at this point.
I know. That's probably going to knock him out.
And by the way, one of the weirdest stats ever is how good the Grizzlies are when he's out. Like, what are they, 17-2 as we record this? It's just an insane record without John Morant. I was talking to the aforementioned Drew Hanlon, who passed this along, said, because Drew works with Jason Tatum and Joel Embiid, said Tatum called him one day recently, and Hanlon was with Embiid. And before he got off the phone, Hanlon put Tatum on speakerphone, and Tatum said to Embiid, you better get the MVP this year, because I'm taking it next year. Like, that's the level of confidence that Jason Tatum has right now in his game, and it's just been... He's really taken off and taken his game to a whole another level this season. All right, I want to finish on a kind of a lighter note, I guess, if you want to call it that. There's been a weird back and forth between Ty Lue and Daryl Morey of the Sixers. It was just a couple of weeks ago where Ty Lue comments after a game talked about Philadelphia and said that they wouldn't even be in the top 10 in scoring without the trips to the free throw line that they were taking. I don't think Ty meant it disparagingly. He was just pointing out that they get to the line a lot, and to keep them from scoring so much, you have to keep them off the free throw line. Daryl Morey took it a little personally. Daryl tweeted out that the Clippers offense would rank 30th in the NBA without free throws, tweeting, say it with me again, players are fouled because the other team cannot stop them. On Monday, Ty Lue was asked about this, and here's what he had to say about Daryl Morey.
They'd be 30th in the league or something like that.
If what? Oh, we didn't shoot free throws?
Yeah, I don't know if you heard about that.
Oh, I mean, they took it out of context. I mean, it was said, man, that, you know, if you continue to foul those guys, they can score 50. We want to make field goals and not free throws because they're crafty getting to the line. But, you know, but, I mean, in response to Daryl Morey, like, I mean, should he really be tweeting anything right now? Last time he tweeted, he cost the NBA $1 billion. So I don't think he should be doing too much tweeting. Just worry about his own team.
Oh, he went for the jugular there, Howard. He's bringing up China and the Hong Kong tweet from a couple of years ago. Like, that's basically escaped everyone's memory. And now Ty Lue brings it back into the water supply once again.
You know, in cases like this, I usually say, you know, nobody wins except for we do, because we get this free entertainment. And this is sometimes what makes the league so much fun, are these little petty squabbles. But in this case, the league's got to be cringing over this. Because as you put it, nobody wants to resurface Daryl Morey's Hong Kong tweet and the damage it caused the league financially, the controversy that it has stirred up, of course, dealings with China.
Not only does Ty Lue bring it up, but he, I think, exaggerated the cost, right? Like, he's like,
hundreds of millions. Yeah, he said a billion. It was hundreds of millions, which is, you know, like, still significant.
No question.
But, I mean, look, if this was just the playground, I'd say, ooh, sick burn. Like, that was pretty good stuff there. That's, like, that's grade A material, but it's also, like, grade A radioactive material. Like, that's not the comeback the league office would have been hoping for. And besides that, as some people already pointed out on Twitter or in the immediate aftermath of that quote going viral, okay, Ty Lue, are you now putting yourself on the side of criticizing Daryl Morey for the China tweet when Daryl Morey was actually standing with, you know...
This is not a conversation the NBA wants to have. It is not. It is not a pool the NBA wants to swim in right now.
No, like, Daryl was standing up for human rights in Hong Kong and political activists in Hong Kong. And that's what caused all this. So, like, this is one where, like, no matter which side of this you're on, if you're within the NBA, you're screwed either way. You're either on you know, if you're on Daryl's side, you're on the side of costing the league hundreds of millions. And if you're anti-Daryl Morey, then does that make you pro-China oppression? Like, this, you know, nobody should be wading into this one. Like, this is rough stuff. But, man, It's too bad we won't see a Clippers-Sixers finals, most likely, because it would get spicy.
NBA was built for social media battles. It really was. Howard, good stuff, man. As always, we'll do it again next week.
Always a pleasure, my friend.